with the potential that the barge could run aground. The Coast Guard is working with and monitoring the Crowley tug crew as they attempt to reestablish the tow.
A tug carrying fuel is adrift north of the Bering Strait. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congress takes up the ANWR debate again.
This is long overdue. This committee has passed this bill 11 times, and it's died in the Senate.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
A barge carrying 140,000 gallons of aviation fuel and 5,800 gallons of gasoline is adrift in the Bering Strait, 11 miles north of the community of Wales. Wales is located right at what is known as the choke point, the 25-mile distance of water between Little Diomede Island and Wales. From KNOM and NOM, Lorelei Kanin has the story.
Early last night, the crew of the 82-foot Sinuk, belonging to Crowley Maritime Corporation, one of the main fuel suppliers to Northwest Alaska, reported that while towing the barge, the line attached to it broke free in heavy weather, with seas up to 15 feet. Public Affairs Specialist for the U.S. Coast Guard, Petty Officer 3rd Class Jonathan Lally, says the tug has not been able to reestablish a tow as of this afternoon. There were reports of winds up to 27 miles per hour and 12 to 15 foot seas. The crew is waiting for calmer weather to reconnect the tug with the barge. A Hercules C-130 flew over the barge this morning to assess the situation, and the Coast Guard said in a release the barge is expected to pass within 8 miles of Fairway Rock, a small granite island between Wales and Little Diomede. Now, there's been talk of the Coast Guard establishing a port in northern Alaska due to the increase in ship traffic. That presence would help in situations like this. Officer Lally says usually in places like California, a cutter would respond and assist.
Due to the remote areas of Alaska, it makes it difficult to get there in such a timely manner for a vessel because of such a large area that they would have to cover.
One of the many who would be grateful for an increased Coast Guard presence is Wenton Wayupuk Jr. of Wales. He works as an environmental specialist for the native village of Wales and says if that 145,000 gallons of fuel happens to spill in the Bering Strait, people would be worried about the harm it could do to their food source. He said in some households, 75% of the food families eat is what is now known as subsistence food, ogruk, seals, walrus, fish, whales, caribou, berries, greens, and the list goes on. The type of food that is gathered changes with the seasons.
At this time, people are gathering clams that wash ashore on the beach here, and I'm sure all that oil, if it spilled, would affect the clams and make people sick if they ate it.
And that is just one food type that he's worried would be affected by a large spill. Meanwhile, the Sinuk remains adrift. Crowley Maritime has sent a second tug, the Siku, and that vessel is on site. Again, U.S. Coast Guard Officer Jonathan Lally.
The Coast Guard takes pollution very seriously, and with the potential that the barge could run aground, the Coast Guard is working with and monitoring the Crowley tug crew as they attempt to reestablish the tow in safer weather conditions and to make sure that when the tug crew can reestablish the tow, that they are able to.
Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinneen.
The decades-long debate over drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge continued in Washington today, this time with a focus on what exploration would mean for jobs and the U.S. economy. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Alaska's congressional delegation appeared in person, and Governor Sean Parnell testified by video conference in a familiar refrain, pressing to develop the Arctic Refuge coastal plain. Congressman Don Young sits on the House Natural Resources Committee that took Wednesday's testimony.
This is long overdue. This committee has passed this bill 11 times, and it's died in the Senate. We have two senators going to help it get it passed. Whether the president will sign it, I do not know.
Only a handful of Democratic committee members were there to voice opposition to opening the Arctic Refuge. Its top Dem, Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts, says the committee should be crafting recommendations to send to the Congressional Supercommittee that's wrangling with the nation's budget problems right now. But Markey says the GOP House is heading the wrong way.
In response to this enormous challenge, the Republican majority is once again looking to drill in the pristine Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. Under the guise of reducing the deficit, they are proposing to open up the crown jewel of the wildlife refuge system to drilling. Unfortunately, drilling in the Arctic Refuge would do very little to reduce our deficit in the next 10 years.
Since Republicans control the House, they steered most of the focus of the witnesses. Among the pro-drilling guests were Kaktovik City Council member Fenton Rexford, Carrie Hall, who's on the TV show Ice Road Truckers, and Fairbanks union leader Tim Sharp. Sharp says opening the refuge would bring jobs to people not just in the interior, but all over the U.S. He warned, however, that he's not a blanket advocate of drill, baby, drill, the battle cry of former Governor Sarah Palin. Instead, Sharp says the process has to be measured and well thought out.
Whether you choose to believe it to be the Serengeti Plain of America or a cold, desolate, godforsaken, mosquito-infested wasteland, there is no all-encompassing absolute that can describe ANWR. The truth is, it is neither of the two, and it falls somewhere in the middle. The picture of the ANWR debate has not really changed in 20 years. However, the frame surrounding the picture has. We're at a time in America where our economy needs an employment jumpstart, energy costs only continue to escalate, and foreign dependence on oil seems to make our economy and our businesses vulnerable in a way that I'm personally uncomfortable with.
The only people invited to testify against drilling in the refuge were David Jenkins with Republicans for Environmental Protection and Gene Karpinski, president of the League of Conservation Voters. Karpinski says there are more innovative and sustainable ways to create jobs.
I would agree with something that Senator Murkowski said earlier. It's too bad we're having this conversation yet again today. And Mr. Chairman, I agree with something you said, which was, quote, reducing our debt will require creative thinking and new approaches. This is neither. This is not creative. It's not new. It's the same old, same old. I've been working on these issues for more than 30 years.
While the two anti-drilling witnesses testified, some of the Republicans on the Natural Resources Committee laughed and talked. A handful were especially jovial when Congressman Young lit into the environmentalists and accused them of not supporting Native people and told them to go read the nation's laws. He peppered them with questions and then didn't let them answer.
And you're sitting in Washington, D.C., you and your friend, just made a fortune out of this job.
Fortune?
Fortune. He's made a fortune. Yes, I happen to know where you are, Washington, D.C. You're sitting around there not letting those people do as they should. Now, I think you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Mr. Chairman, I think you really should be ashamed.
I'm not answering you. I'm not asking you a question.
You talked about me.
Just keep quiet.
While Congress is again battling over the question of whether to open ANWR, Wednesday in Anchorage, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is finishing up a series of public hearings on its comprehensive conservation plan for the entire Arctic Refuge. Two of its six alternatives recommend wilderness protection for the Arctic Refuge coastal plain. The plan does stress that only Congress has the power to designate wilderness. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Another Stryker Brigade soldier from Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks has died in Afghanistan. 29-year-old Specialist Ryan J. Cook from Florida died September 18th when insurgents attacked his unit with an IED. Another soldier from the brigade was wounded in the same incident but not identified. Next of kin have been notified. The 4,000-soldier Stryker Brigade deployed to Afghanistan in mid-April 2011 for a one-year tour. 12 other soldiers have died in the 6 months the brigade has been deployed. The nation's F-22 fighter jets are back in service 4 months after they were grounded over pilot complaints about a lack of oxygen. Air Force officials began flying the stealth planes again today following a stand-down order imposed over hypoxia issues reported by at least 12 pilots in the last 3 years. The Air Force has studied the plane for months, and officials announced this week that the analysis of data collected prompted the return to service. More information about what led to the decision was not immediately available. The planes and pilots will be subjected to additional inspections and testing. Nearly a year ago, an F-22 crashed in interior Alaska, but Air Force Chief of Staff General Norton Schwartz told reporters yesterday that they are convinced that crash was not due to the oxygen problem. The Air Force has 170 Raptors, 40 of them based at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new idea for getting some use out of the Matsu Ferry.
Every time I go into Ketchikan and see that doggone ship sitting there, it makes me ill.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
A group of 40 Alaskans, including a dozen legislators, have returned from a tour of Norway, where their goal was to get a look at another oil economy. The trip was organized by the Institute of the North. Larry Pursley, the Federal Natural Gas Pipeline Coordinator, says the participants found a few areas in which Norway deals with the oil and gas industry differently than Alaska, and says there was interest in exploring the new ideas. At the top of the list was Norway's state direct financial investment policy, where the government itself actually owns a percentage of everything that is produced as neither operator nor regulator, but as shareholder.
They realize certainly that you're going to have to lay out a lot of money up front for capital development, exploration, building production facilities, and it's going to take years before you get a return when oil starts flowing. But people did seem interested as a way to go forward to more closely align the state with oil and gas development and to give Alaskans, you know, the state of Alaska, a vote in development by being one of the partners in fields.
Pursley says Alaskans on the trip also were interested to learn that oil and gas companies do not pay in advance to develop properties. Alaska awards a lease to the highest bidder, but Pursley says the Alaskans like the Norwegian idea of awarding leases based on merit.
There's no cash up front. It's who gives the best development plan based on experience, expertise, geological knowledge, work commitments. And there was a lot of interest in, would that work for Alaska? Would that serve us better rather than getting a cash up front on a bonus bid?
Senate President Gary Stevens was among those attending the sessions. He also stopped for a related tour of Iceland. He points to other elements of government, such as using oil proceeds to develop domestic energy sources, particularly renewable energy.
What I've learned is that there are lots of options out there, lots of possibilities, and we have to look at all of them. We can't just, fixate on one issue. We just have to look at all of them, whether it's hydro or using the gas or whatever, coal even, we have lots of options there.
While in Norway, the Alaskans had the opportunity to meet with top government officials. Pursley and Stevens say there are several things Alaska will not try to duplicate: a 50% personal income tax, a 25% value-added sales tax, or a 78% tax on offshore oil profits. Pursley says the markets are different too. Norway's customers are mostly in Europe, a lot closer to the resource than Alaska's customers, and there is little use of the energy within Norway. The exporter relies almost entirely on hydroelectric and other renewable resources for its own power. Some legislators are suggesting the Alaska Marine Highway System take over the ferry Susitna. The $78 million vessel was built to connect Anchorage and the lower Matanuska-Susitna borough, but there's no place for it to dock, and it's unclear how it will be used. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Ketchikan's Alaska Ship and Dry Dock is finishing up work on the experimental ferry Susitna.
Right now it's undergoing sea trials, and it still remains, it needs to be outfitted with seats, and the borough hasn't even taken title yet of the ship.
Matsu Borough spokeswoman Patty Sullivan says it may not take possession until spring. Eventually, it hopes to sail the ship in northern Cook Inlet, connecting Anchorage and Point Mackenzie, and possibly Kenai and Tyonek. But no ferry ramps have been built, so officials are looking for other options.
The borough is interested in gathering any sort of ideas, interest in how to use the ferry while we work on the landings. If Alaska Marine Highway is interested, we certainly are interested in speaking with them.
She says it's too early to say how much the borough would charge. Juneau Senator Dennis Egan recently toured the Susitna, and he was impressed.
Every time I go into Ketchikan and see that dung on ship sitting there, it makes me ill. I mean, $78 million and, you know, it's just sitting there.
Egan wants the Alaska Marine Highway System to consider using the Susitna as a fill-in vessel or for a regular route. He recently led a delegation of Juneau lawmakers to a meeting with ferry officials.
I'm not talking about stealing it from the Matsu Borough. I'm talking about the state of Alaska reimbursing the Matsu Borough if, in fact, we can use it.
The State Transportation Department has looked into the craft. Ferry Chief Mike Neusel says adding it to the fleet would be difficult.
The problem really comes in that trying to operate a high-speed craft that is incompatible with all of our existing shore facilities is a difficult evolution. The training, the route manuals, the certifications, the maintenance, and just the startup operation to take on a vessel like that is labor-intensive, time-consuming, and expensive.
The Susitna is a first-of-a-kind vessel, developed and paid for by the Navy. It can adjust its height above water, break through ice, and land on a beach. Its capacity is smaller than all but one state ferry, about 20 vehicles and 135 passengers. And Neusel says even if it could be used, it wouldn't be for long.
Theoretically, as far as I know, Matsu Borough still intends to use that as a passenger ferry in Upper Cook Inlet, and it'll eventually go to that service. So to do all the work necessary to make it a marine highway system vessel running some route someplace, only to have that be taken back to go to its intended purpose some time later, doesn't seem cost-effective in my view.
Juneau Senator Egan says he's not convinced that's true, and he'll keep pursuing the idea. Docking the Susitna is expensive, about $1.3 million a year in Ketchikan and more in Cook Inlet. So the borough is motivated to see the ship used once it takes possession. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A key federal funding program for local schools in the Tongass and other national forests could once again be linked to logging levels as it was prior to 2001. The U.S. House is considering a draft bill that would substantially change the funding source for the Secure Rural Schools program, which has come under more scrutiny as Congress looks to cut spending. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The National Forest County Revenue, Schools, and Jobs Act would basically revive the old forest or timber receipt program for funding schools and roads in towns and counties on the nation's forests. But the draft language before the House Natural Resources Committee takes timber receipts a step further by requiring the Secretary of Agriculture generate a predetermined amount of revenue each year through timber sales, mining, hydropower, recreation, and other projects. That would replace the current system, which is funded by the U.S. Treasury. According to House Resources Chair Doc Hastings, a Republican representative from Washington State, the point is to provide revenue to communities by encouraging more economic activity on public lands.
It goes back to the idea that our forest lands, national forest lands, are multiple-use forest lands, and obviously commercial activity is part of that. And so we are just simply setting targets there for the goals for the federal government to reach in support of that for these local local counties.
The annual payments to schools and counties have come from the federal treasury since 2000, when Congress passed the Secure Rural Schools Act to help compensate for a substantial decline in timber harvests. Secure Schools decoupled the program's dependence on controversial resource extraction projects and stabilized the annual payments with treasury funds. Petersburg, for example, has been receiving over $1.2 million a year. Congress has renewed Secure Schools a couple times over the past decade, but it expires again this fall as lawmakers move to slash federal spending. With the federal deficit, Hastings does not think the current program is sustainable. Reverting to the timber receipts model, at least in concept, has support among some proponents of Secure Rural Schools funding. Jim French is president of the National Forest Counties and Schools Coalition.
I think we've always believed that straight, pure, decoupled Secure Rural Schools funding would come to an end, and I think it's time to have meaningful dialogue on further managing our forests appropriately and generating the revenues that we've received for loss of federal lands that goes back all the way to 1908.
While the Secure Rural Schools Act had bipartisan support, this new measure could prove more divisive. The draft measure would substantially reduce requirements for environmental study and public review for timber sales and other activities that the secretary designates as county, schools, and revenue trust projects. It also includes a provision prohibiting judicial review of the environmental studies for those projects. Juneau attorney Tom Waldo with the environmental law firm Earth Justice says the draft bill would waive all the environmental laws applicable on the Tongass.
The bottom line is that the bill is a cynical attempt by some members of Congress to use rural schools as the sacrificial lambs in a play to try to increase logging in the national forests.
The Obama administration proposed a 5-year extension of the Secure Rural Schools Act earlier this year. While that would still be funded by the Treasury, it would also ratchet down payments substantially until it expired. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
And by
Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
A 65-year-old man is hospitalized after being mauled by a grizzly bear while hunting in Alaska. Donald Skip Sanford was attacked Monday near the McLaren River Lodge off the Denali Highway. Rescuers say Sanford told them the bear charged at him head down. Joe Snyder helped tend to Sanford's wounds. He says the hunter has deep bites to the back of his skull and one ear is torn. Alaska state troopers say the wounds don't appear to be life-threatening. Fort Wainwright will pay a fine of more than $79,000 to settle a complaint by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that the Post failed to shut down three facilities that violated the federal Clean Drinking Water Law by 2005 and then failed to properly document the closures until this year. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Fort Wainwright Public Works Director Mike Meeks says the three motor vehicle waste disposal injection wells that prompted the EPA fine are known by a more recognizable name.
Our injection wells, the three that were cited, are actually a septic system.
Meeks says the so-called injection wells were located at the Post Golf Course, Ski Hill, and Landfill, all of which had a building in which vehicles were parked.
Each one of those had a small area, concrete slab, inside of a warm building, and in there was a drain. That drain went straight through an oil and water separator and then out to the septic system, and from the septic system to the leach field.
Meeks says Post officials responded to EPA's 1999 regulation by plugging the drain in the golf course maintenance bay, but didn't properly document that, nor follow up with testing to ensure no automotive fluids had leaked into the ground or groundwater. He says post officials directed staff not to use the drains in the maintenance bays at the ski hill and landfill, but did not modify those drain systems, nor did they test at the landfill because they'd already been testing there as part of a separate program to clean up and monitor that facility, which had already been identified as a pollution problem. Meeks says post officials believed they'd addressed the problems. He now concedes that wasn't enough. And Christopher, an environmental scientist with EPA's Region 10 office in Seattle, says the agency didn't get Fort Wainwright's final documents on work done last summer to alter the drain systems and follow-up testing until March. EPA officials say systems such as these that allow toxic substances such as automotive fluids to escape into the environment pose a big risk to groundwater. They also violate the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The head of the Arctic Region Supercomputing Center is carrying on the legacy of the man who created the electronic book. ARSC Director Greg Newby is volunteer head of Project Gutenberg, a nonprofit organization begun by ebook creator Michael Hart. Hart, who digitized the first book back in 1971, died earlier this month. Newby has been involved with Project Gutenberg since meeting Hart in New York in the 1980s. Newby says his friend was a visionary.
These were, you know, just completely wacky ideas 40 years ago. And even 10 years ago, people were not ready to think about that. But he had the foresight to see that the technologies and computer networks way back when in very early days would someday be a major mechanism by which people would experience literature, would grow their own literacy, and would have opportunity to empower themselves through better literacy and access to information.
Volunteers with Project Gutenberg digitize books in the public domain for which copyrights have run out. The project offers access to more than 30,000 books online. While other groups and businesses distribute ebooks today, Newby says Project Gutenberg remains unique.
Project Gutenberg is the one that has probably the most open attitude towards the variety of content, the variety of genres, authors, so forth. Also about 60 different languages and dozens of different computer formats. So we are very much into sort of unlocking the pathways to literature as opposed to having people follow through our particular pathway, our particular method. And that, of course, is a major distinguishing factor between us and the commercial devices that really sort of want to lock you in. But it also distinguishes us from many of the other free efforts that are out there.
Newby, who handles legal, fiscal, and technology issues as Project Gutenberg's unpaid director, says it's estimated there's about 1 million books in the public domain, providing no shortage of work for project volunteers to digitize and post for free online. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.